economic infrastructure. This will escalate towards a war in which all of those different things will be targeted, both on the Iranian side as well as on the Israeli side.
And Tzvita, finally, if you could talk about, respond to the fact that Netanyahu, much like we spoke about this in our earlier segment on Lebanon, much like as he did with Lebanon, gave a direct address to the Lebanese people, he did the same with Iran last month, saying with every passing moment, the Iranian government is bringing the noble Persian people closer to the abyss. What is the significance of this, and why is he doing that?
Well, he's done this on previous occasions as well, not only in the context of Gaza and Lebanon, but in the case of Iran as well. I think the primary target of this is actually not the Iranian public. The message was in English, and the original video had English subtitles. This is a message to the Western audience in order to present Israel's war of aggression as a defensive war, as a war that will help get rid of a very unpopular regime in Iran. And as a result, just as with the Iraq war, this deserves the support of the Western publics because the government in Iran is so problematic, similar to the argument against Saddam Hussein. And remember, it was Netanyahu who testified in Congress back right before the Iraq war, promising that an attack on Iraq would have positive reverberations throughout the entire region.
Thank you, Tzvita Parsi. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Tzvita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and The Triumph of Diplomacy. And that does it for our show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another...
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's governor calls families with this message, keep those kids in school. Oregon congresswomen lead a roundtable talk about the upcoming election's impact on reproductive rights. And having that hard talk with a loved one about long-term care in Oregon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 17, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. So glad you're with us tonight. Oregon Governor Tina Kotchek joined in a phone bank effort in Salem to encourage hundreds of families to improve students' attendance records in school. Here's part of what she said.
I'm at Waldo Middle School here in Salem. Go Mustangs. We're calling families to talk about the importance of their kids showing up for school.
This is Governor Tina Kotchek calling.
A lot of folks may be surprised to hear that if a child misses 2 school days each month, they're missing 10% of the school year, and that's a lot. School attendance is a powerful predictor of educational success. It takes all of us working together to help every child succeed. I talked to some families who are saying, my kid loves math, or I make sure my kid gets to sleep on time, or we talk about homework after dinner. So there are a lot of things that parents are doing to make sure their kids show up. So you know what? Every day matters. We can all do our part for our students, from our first graders to our seniors, to feel that joy of learning and that sense of belonging. So remember, when it comes to attendance, every day matters.
That's Oregon Governor Tina Kotchek. In Oregon, if a student misses 10% of the school year, or about 2 days each month, they're considered chronically absent, which is linked to lower reading levels, dropping out before graduation, suspensions, substance abuse, and poor health outcomes. This month, millions of people in Oregon and across the country are enrolling in Medicare. Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden met with local seniors and their supporters to talk about some of the new Medicare Advantage protections he's worked on and more safeguards he's hoping to enact as the chairman of the U.S. Senate Finance Committee.
Today's the day when the hype begins, all right? Every time you turn around, by the way, I guess I qualify as a senior. I've already received a bunch of stuff at the door. 506,000 people are eligible for what's ahead. And October can be frightening. I think we understand that, but doesn't just mean Halloween. It means getting bombarded by a lot of these policies. And on the Finance Committee, we've been able to make some changes, and I want to make sure folks understand the progress and then what we got to do. The first thing that I'm really proud of is that these companies, some of them that are always looking for a fast buck, can't sell your information again and again. And I think that's going to make a big difference. The second thing that we got changed is they can't sell plans that look like tax forms, because we all saw a lot of those over the last year or two, and you think you're getting something from the government, you got consumer protection, and you don't. And the third thing is that the plans can't advertise benefits that they don't make available in our area. Okay, so that's another big thing to derail some of the hype. But the fact is, we got a long way to go, and I'm going to tell you about some of the things that we're working on now. The first is, we've had a big problem with something called prior authorization. Have some of you heard about that? Prior authorization means what it sounds like. You can't get your care until some bean counter somewhere says okay. And insurers are using prior authorization as red tape to delay and deny care. In 2022, Medicare Advantage plans denied 46 million coverage requests, the equivalent of every person in Oregon times 10. And I'm hearing constantly from seniors and others and providers, for example, who hear that these plans are using what we call the deny first system that guarantees unnecessary delays to accessing care and big paperwork burdens for you and the providers. So those are some areas that we're focused on. And a second one is something called ghost networks. And these are one of the biggest ripoffs ever. And maybe some of you have seen this as well, where you buy a policy, you purchase a policy, and there's no there. There's no providers there. You get told you can see somebody in a year or something like that. How many of you have been up against trying to see a provider? Delays and hassles, right? Okay. And third, we're concerned about the broker commissions. These are the people who come in and just keep selling and selling. And the plans are allowed to pay some brokers more money with no gains for seniors for enrolling them in certain plans through extra expenses. And I have asked the government agency that deals with this, they're called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to crack down on ripoffs that are taking place through brokers. And in particular, I want the government to remove the incentives to brokers to enroll seniors in plans that was really the good one for seniors, not for the brokers to make more money. If we can have a system that rewards incentives for helping you, fine. But in systems that provide incentives for insurance brokers, not so fast. That's a little bit about what we've achieved in the last year, but we still got a ways to go. Some of you remember when I got the law passed for traditional Medicare. It was something called Medigap, and some people still use Medigap. And you can buy one policy. It's like within a handful of alternatives. We've got to get that kind of simplicity. And I want you to know that I recognize that traditional Medicare, which I got changed a number of years ago to provide simplicity, has some features that we still are concerned about because you have fee-for-service kind of medicine. But Medicare Advantage, which coordinates care, still has to do a better job of delivering value for that money. And let me ask, how many of you have Providence? Okay. Do you have the Medicare Advantage plan, the coordinated care? Good. Okay. Working okay? Not too many delays? Tell us about it.
They told me that wasn't covered. I've been covered since January.
So let's, did you get that? He's going to get called back next year. So let's talk about that in terms of what you can do. We've got a wonderful person here from an organization known as SHIBA. And I've been working with them for years. Grace is here from our office, and we've got really good people. There are places where you can turn. You're not out there just all by yourselves. A lot of these policies operate under the assumption that seniors are trying to figure out all these complicated systems, and they can just stick you with a bill, and nobody's going to push back. We're the pusher backs. We're the people who are out there trying to make sure you get a fair shake. Let's hear from some of the rest. Yes, ma'am.
So, I don't know about anybody else, but my doctor left medicine back in March, and I'm having a heck of a time trying to find a primary care physician.
We're trying to make, at the end of the year, in the big budget agreement, the primary focus of the government's health care policy would be on primary care. Back in the day, Medicare was mostly acute care. You broke your leg, you went to the hospital and it was Part A, and you had a really lousy case of the flu. Now with Medicare Part B and you went to the doctor, that mostly isn't Medicare today. Medicare today is mostly chronic care. Now you can live much longer. All over the state, I'm hearing from seniors telling me they can't get primary care.
And that was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden meeting with people at the Hollywood Senior Center in Northeast Portland. Throughout Oregon, family caregivers typically play a critical role in long-term care decisions that can involve tough but necessary conversations. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
October is long-term care planning month, and a few tips can help people when talking with their loved ones about this topic. Conversations about long-term care can be difficult. AARP Oregon State Director Bandana Shrestha says approaching the topic with compassion and care is key. She also notes that 470,000 family caregivers in Oregon provide most of the care for close friends and family members and need to be part of planning conversations.
Making sure that you're talking early is really important, and also making sure you are involving all parties who may be responsible for supporting somebody is really important.
The population of people over age 65 is increasing rapidly in the U.S., and most will need long-term care supports of some kind, underscoring the need to begin planning for how that care will look. Open enrollment for Medicare began this week and lasts through December 7th, but Shrestha notes the insurance program doesn't cover long-term care.
There are certain provisions within Medicare where you can get some supports for being able to have short stays in long-term care facilities. But otherwise, Medicare is really about your health care. It's your health insurance.
Oregon performed well on AARP's recent long-term services and support scorecard, ranking number 7 in the nation. Although the state could do better in areas such as affordability, Shrestha says the state ranks high in terms of support for family caregivers.
The reasons for that are policies like our recent paid leave law, which really is designed to help ensure that people have supports and can take time off when they need to care for themselves or for their loved ones.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon Congresswomen Andrea Salinas and Suzanne Bonamici led a roundtable talk recently with other lawmakers and healthcare leaders about the upcoming election's possible impacts on reproductive rights and freedoms in Oregon and across the country. Congresswoman Salinas led this meeting.
20 days left until Election Day, and ballots are supposed to drop today, and so much is on the line. And it has been especially terrifying that the thought of another Trump presidency, and I'm sure you've heard about Project 2025, it spells it all out in there. And it truly does feel like a very sci-fi, Handmaid's Tale kind of apocalyptic scenario for women. And I don't feel like I'm exaggerating when I say that either, right? Thank you. Okay, so it's an extreme policy agenda. It was handcrafted by officials from the first Trump administration with input from several well-known anti-abortion groups like the Alliance for Defending Freedom. It includes a ban on medication abortion, certain forms of birth control, emergency contraception, effectively banning abortion access nationwide, even in states like Oregon, who guarantee access to these life-saving medications for an estimated 614,000 women here in Oregon. Calls on hospitals to refrain from providing emergency abortion care, which would inevitably lead to more women bleeding out and dying on operating tables. Women are dying in places like Georgia and Texas. Medical professionals are being criminalized, and politicians are meddling in deeply personal health care decisions. Not here in Oregon, though, thankfully, because we've had these two wonderful women.
And you too.
Yeah, thank you.
You had a lot to do with that, too.
I did, yes.
And that was Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas. Mammograms at a younger age can help doctors find breast cancer earlier when it's more treatable. Eric Tegedoff reports on what a doctor in the Pacific Northwest is saying about this.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and health professionals are urging women to get screened at earlier ages than previously suggested. After skin cancer, breast cancer is the most diagnosed form of cancer for women in the U.S. Dr. Ann Gaiman with Kaiser Permanente in Seattle says there's been an increase in breast cancer rates in women in the 40 to 50 age range. She says previous recommendations were that women should speak with their healthcare provider after age 40 about when to start screening.
These new recommendations from the United States Preventive Services Task Force states that all women should begin screening now at age 40 and repeat screening every other year through age 74.
About 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer in their lifetime, according to the American Cancer Society, which also says breast cancer rates in Washington state are higher than the national average, and screening rates are lower. The state has the 9th highest cancer rate in the country and the 10th lowest screening rate. Gaiman adds it isn't clear what's driving up the numbers for younger women.
We don't know, but we know that younger women can get often quite aggressive forms of cancer. So these new recommendations help us to get more young women having regular screenings, which can help to intervene earlier.
Gaiman says there are new treatments to target breast cancer and more research is being done because some forms are still hard to treat. But she notes some big improvements in breast cancer survival rates.
A lot of that is thought to be due to the increased rates of screening because the earlier we catch breast cancer, the more treatable it is, right? If we can catch it before it's moved outside of the breast, your prognosis is much better.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy early with cloudy skies overnight, a low 44. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with a high of 57. Today in history, on this date in 1931, gangster Al Capone was convicted of tax evasion. He was later sentenced to 11 years in federal prison. Our quote of the day is from Capone, who said, "They can't collect legal taxes from illegal money." The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center says there's a 60% chance that a weak La Nina will develop this fall. It could last until March. La Nina is the cool phase of a natural global climate pattern involving changes in wind and ocean temperatures across the Pacific. El Nino happens when winds that usually blow across the Pacific toward Asia weaken, allowing warm ocean waters to accumulate along the western edge of South America. But during La Nina, the trade winds intensify and cold water from the deeper part of the ocean rises up, resulting in cooler than average temperatures in the eastern Pacific. The cold ocean temperatures affect the position of the jet stream, a band of fast-moving air flowing from west to east around the Earth by bumping it north. The jet stream can tap into ocean moisture, influence the path storms take, and cause more rain. La Nina can result in extreme weather across the planet. Although there's no guarantee how this La Nina will play out, there are some general trends. Experts say northern parts of South America could see more rain than usual, while southern regions of the U.S. and parts of Mexico could be drier than average. The northern U.S. and southern Canada are also expected to be wetter than average. We experienced a triple dip event from 2020 to 2023, with 3 back-to-back La Nina winters. That was unusual because the only other case of that happening occurred from 1973 to 1976. La Nina events can be especially stressful for regions that have been dealing with drought. Scientists say the link between climate change and La Nina and El Nino is not clear. Many climate models are indicating more frequent El Niños and less frequent La Niñas, but not all agree. This week, the nonprofit Portland for All held a webinar answering questions about how ranked choice voting could impact Portland in November's election. Leading the talk was a Multnomah County expert.
My name is Leah Benson. I use she and they pronouns. I am the Ranked Choice Voting Project Manager at Multnomah County Elections. At the County Elections Division, we oversee the administration of every election within Multnomah County for all of the cities within it, including the city of Portland. I think being in this role, I get asked a lot, how long have you been working in elections? Like, what's your background? To which I get to say, my background is in bikes. I come from the bike industry, which may seem like an odd connection. But for several years, I owned and ran a small bike shop in Northeast Portland, Gladys Bikes. And in 2019, when I left that role, I took an inventory of what I wanted to do next and thought about what I was good at and what I had to give. And turns out what I'm really great at is diving into the abyss, taking a whole bunch of things, bringing them together and building systems that work. So around this time was also when Portland was going through a transition and deciding on a new form of government. And I decided that this is where I wanted to engage most. And so started my journey serving on the Government Transition Advisory Committee through the City of Portland. And in that, really begun to fully immerse myself in ranked choice voting. And I'm thrilled to now be able to do it.
That's Leah Benson, the Ranked Choice Voting Project Manager at Multnomah County Elections. Reports of intimidating text messages targeting college students and recent graduates are prompting more voting rights outreach to younger voters. Judith Rees Branch reports.
The anonymous text message warns recipients about voting in a state where they are not eligible and says they could be fined or jailed for violating Wisconsin state law. Molly Carmichael is a recent graduate who works with the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. She said the first thing she noticed when she got the text was the harsh language.
Right off the bat, I was pretty upset because I figured this was also going out to other people, maybe people who have never voted before and are excited to vote this November. And so getting a text like that would certainly be really alarming.
The League of Women Voters, along with Free Speech for People, petitioned the Wisconsin and U.S. Departments of Justice to investigate the matter. Carmichael says they've also started a digital campaign promoting the Election Protection Hotline, trying to counter the harmful text with positive and correct information and resources. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
Voters in eight states are considering amendments to ban non-citizens from voting. Georgians smash early voting records, and Texas Senate candidates debate who is a greater threat to democracy. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
There's a lot of deterrent for non-citizens to not vote in Wisconsin. It would be very risky on a lot of dimensions for non-citizens to decide to vote.
University of Wisconsin law professor Bree Grossi-Wilde says a state constitutional amendment to ban non-citizen voting is scary and unnecessary. Seven other states have taken up similar measures, but it's already illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections. And in spite of the conspiracy theory, it almost never happens. Immigration was a central topic of Vice President Kamala Harris's first extended Fox interview. To sharp questions about harm from migrants, she again pointed to Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, blocking efforts to fix border policy. Georgians are breaking early voting records, casting 500,000 ballots in just 3 days. Tia Mitchell with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution says voters know it's a battleground state.
Every vote in Georgia is going to count. Georgia is expected to be close, and so it's in the margins, and I think people are just fired up.
Meanwhile, citing potential chaos and delay, Georgia judges have blocked a state rule that workers have to hand count ballots and said county election officials have to certify election results in a week. Polls show Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is very narrowly leading his Democratic challenger, Congressman Colin Allred. In their first and only debate, they sparred over abortion rights, immigration, and January 6th. Allred said Cruz's support for law enforcement should include the Capitol Police.
You can't be for the mob on January 6th and for the officers. You can't. And it's not funny, because you're a threat to democracy.
Cruz called Allred's voting record extreme and said his failure to support legislation banning non-citizens from voting was the real threat to democracy. Voters in Ohio will soon decide the fate of State Issue 1, aimed at creating a citizen-led redistricting commission. Supporters say it's meant to reduce gerrymandering, but Annette Tucker Sutherland with the League of Women Voters of Ohio says a court-approved change to include the word gerrymander in the measure misrepresents the true intent.
I never in my life thought I'd be telling people, don't read carefully what's on the ballot and then vote.
Early voting begins today in North Carolina, with the western part of the state still early in recovering from Hurricane Helene. Election officials there have extended the deadline to request a mail-in ballot until November 4th. With a North Carolina man already facing charges for threatening FEMA workers, storm-ravaged parts of Tennessee have reported armed groups threatening agency employees. Carter County Sheriff Mike Fraley says misinformation accusing FEMA of seizing property is putting lives at risk.
Those FEMA workers, they're here to help. And if you don't want FEMA's help, then, you know, politely tell them so. But they are human beings just like we are.
I'm Catherine Carley.
Crime- Crime survivors in California are speaking out against Proposition 36, which is on the ballot in November, Suzanne Potter reports.
The ballot measure would increase penalties for some theft and drug crimes and undo parts of Prop 47, which took savings from decreased incarceration and plowed it into harm reduction programs. Tanish Hollins with Californians for Safety and Justice spoke Wednesday at the opening of a new trauma recovery center in Oakland.
It's pushing the state to move back towards tough on crime. We are pushing back on that. You need to prioritize resources to create trauma recovery centers, because this is the way that we increase safety in our communities.
Supporters of Prop 36 say current laws are too lenient, particularly concerning retail theft. The state legislative analyst says Prop 36 will send many more people to jail, increasing criminal justice costs anywhere from tens of millions to the low hundreds of millions of dollars each year. Hollins says that will mean less money for programs that actually address poverty and desperation, the root causes of crime.
Folks who have been touched by incarceration, the folks who are experiencing homelessness, folks who are experiencing barriers to employment, they can actually get a full range of services to stabilize. Think about how impactful this will be if we're able to continue expanding this model.
Advocates project that Prop 36 will mean $850 million less over the next decade for trauma recovery centers, mental health, drug treatment, victims' services, reentry, and crime prevention programs. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Tribal members in Nevada are among the 300,000 who can vote online. A Native Seed Sovereignty Act is proposed in Congress, and California's K-12 students will start to learn about Native genocide starting in the new year. With those stories and more, here's Brian Bull from Eugene, Oregon, with National Native News.
Tribal members living on reservations and colonies in Nevada are now among the roughly 300,000 Americans who can cast a ballot online. Nevada Public Radio's Paul Boger reports.
The Native American Rights Fund estimates that the average turnout among indigenous voters during the last six election cycles was 37%. Turnout among white voters averaged around 51%. One reason is that tribal communities have faced historical and geographic obstacles to casting a ballot, including a lack of polling locations and unreliable mail service.
One of the day-to-day challenges that you've come to accept.
That's Brian Mason, chairman of the Shoshone Paiute Tribes of the Duck Valley Reservation, which straddles the Nevada-Idaho state line. In previous elections, the nearest polling location was open only on Election Day, 2 hours away. Mason says a lot of people didn't get a chance to vote.
You know, in the past, it's been, well, if you couldn't make it to Elko, then you just didn't make it to Elko.
This year, voters living on the Duck Valley Reservation or any of the 27 other tribal communities in the state can vote online using Nevada's Digital Effective Absentee System for Elections, or EASE for short. The state developed it in 2014 to allow members of the armed forces overseas and others to cast absentee ballots online. Matilda Miller is with Native Voters Alliance of Nevada, one of the organizations that pushed for the expansion. She says EASE, along with voting by mail, allows Native voters in Nevada to have their voices heard like never before.
I think it's a great opportunity, and I think it's great to see that this voting tool is being expanded to our people.
Opponents of electronic voting have expressed doubts about the EASE system's security. For Miller, those concerns are part of an effort to continue disenfranchising Native voters.
I'm hoping that with more years, more elections, and the more education that's going to continue to happen, that more people are able to take advantage of the system.
As for in-person voting, the Nevada Secretary of State's office says there'll be 18 polling locations open on tribal land on Election Day, as well as 12 early voting locations and 8 ballot drop boxes available to Native voters throughout the state. For National Native News, I'm Paul Boger in Reno.
Tribes may soon have support in growing and maintaining traditional plants. Democratic Congresswoman Norma Torres has introduced legislation called the Native American Seed Act. Torres says if passed, her bill would allow the U.S. Department of the Interior and tribes to determine and protect seeds important to their members.
A way for Native Americans to begin to develop their own seed bank based on the agricultural plants that they traditionally have known from their very beginning.
Torres is a member of the Congressional Native American Caucus. Her legislation was jointly introduced with Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa of California. Torres says this bipartisan effort began when she visited a tribe in New Mexico that had constructed a modest seed bank.
Their way of cultivating the goods that we eat is something that we should highlight and we should be very proud of. My bill begins a process to get Native tribes focused on saving their seeds for future generations.
Movements for food sovereignty and reclaiming traditional plants have picked up steam in the last few years. Tara says her bill will help build on that momentum. And a new California bill educating K-12 school children on the attempted genocide of Native Americans goes into effect January 1st. The Oregonian reports that Governor Gavin Newsom signed the bill in September. The curriculum will educate students on the California Native tribes who endured violence, oppression, and atrocities during the Spanish colonial period and the Gold Rush. Supporters say it also teaches about the resiliency of Native people. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 17th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Judith Ruiz Branch. The producer is myself, Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, up next.